Well, welcome to the Moral and Ethical Leadership Podcast, hosted by the BYU Management Society Salt Lake Chapter. I'm Dave Austin.
And I'm Kurt Frankum.
Wow, we hope you are all safe and healthy during this incredibly difficult time. We've been doing this podcast for about a year with our monthly luncheon speakers, and due to the crisis that we are currently in, we want to change it up a little bit. We want to start a new guest series called Voices of Hope.
We know that there are a lot of people suffering out there right now, whether it's physically, emotionally, economically, and our hope is to bring you guests who can uplift, inspire, and have honest conversations with us, and hopefully a little bit of fun as well. And we'd like to have guest interviews on hopefully somewhat regular basis, maybe even weekly, and hopefully this can help us get through and distract us during this time.
We're so grateful this week to have Super Bowl MVP, former BYU QB, and all-around great guy, Steve Young. And we're in for a real treat as well, as we have two guest interviewers this week, Associate Athletic Director at BYU, Chad Lewis, and Attorney General for the State of Utah, Sean Reyes. Everyone, welcome.
Oh, yeah.
What's up, guys?
Hi, buddy. I tell you what, this is a hit parade with you two guys. Holy cow.
No way.
Steve, this is an incredible opportunity for us, and I wanted to ask, and then I'll turn it over to Chad and the Attorney General. How are you doing, and what have you been up to during this crisis?
Well, you know, San Francisco, I mean, actually Stanford University and Harvard the same day closed down, and that was the first thing that closed that made me feel like, you know, wow, this is really serious, and that was early March. And then soon after, some of the Silicon Valley companies had done the same thing. And then, as you recall, it was the Bay Area led by the mayor of San Francisco, the shelter in place. That was the first thing, and said, look, we got to do this. And now looking back, we've been at it now 3.5 weeks, and you've seen the statistics in the Bay Area. It really is amazing, although clearly it's been difficult for everybody to stay in. For our family, it's been a blessing. I mean, we got our son home from Manhattan School of Music, Braden, just in time. And so we've been here for 3.5 weeks just being together. And I can't tell you what a joy it's been, what a blessing it's been to be with each other and you know, and have that time. I mean, it's an unheard of. I get up and go, you know, get a little work done in the morning, and you feed everybody and then feed them again. And you're just around the dinner table. You know, I'm very grateful where no one's ill in the home. We've had some dear friends that have had tragedies happen through COVID-19. You know Bob Garf, who's a good friend of all of ours, who passed away. His cousin Blair is fighting for his life in Southern California. And so this has been trying and a blessing at the same time. So, I mean, we've seen all the devastation all over the world. And so this is just it's a nutty thing. And I think we all ask ourselves every day, is this real? We kind of wonder, what's it going to look like on the other side of it? And it is a concern. But so the silver lining is our family being together, but obviously with amazing pain and sorrow around the world.
Steve, the Attorney General and I will pepper you with some questions.
All right, let's do this.
As I've thought about them, I want to know, like, what people would like to know about you that they don't know already, and what I would like to know about you. So here's the first question. And it's deals with your family. And you have three brothers who are doctors. You're an attorney, and you got your sister Melissa, but three brothers, Mike, Tom, Jimbo, who are in the medical profession. And they're guys who have, you've been a trailblazer for them, and you've been an example for them. They love you like crazy. I've seen them, the way they've followed you and supported you for years. And I just want to know what their support and friendship through the years means to you.
Well, you know, it's strange. We, Chad, I appreciate that. My dad was traveling a lot when we were growing up. And with four boys and then Melissa, of course, my mom had her hands full. And I think more than anything, I don't know how to explain it. I guess family is just this way, but as brothers and Melissa, we've just stayed close from like, I feel like I've had the same relationship with every one of them from the first time I saw them till today. It's steady. It's, you can, we cannot see each other for 6 months, 6 weeks, 6 days, 6 hours. It's the same. And it's the same with my folks as well. There were a couple of years when I saw my folks once or twice, but then, you know, I know our family's just built for to go in the distance. And I think our, my brothers, the communication, the trust, the space that we give each other. I've never been in, I can't remember being in an argument with anyone in my family. And I guess that's my dad's the one that got the most angry because, that's just a little bit more of his personality. But my mother was an incredible peacemaker. She would give her left arm for peace. And I really mean that too. I think that she would do anything for peace in our home, in our relationships. And I've seen her go 10 miles, 15 miles out of her way to make sure that she made it okay for folks and more peaceful. And I think that that's just been the part of our lives that we've taken from our parents, just a sense of there's nothing worth losing the peace we have with each other. And so I don't want to jinx it now that we've come this far, but my brothers, you know, I talked to them quite a bit. I talked to Melissa just the other day. And honestly, it is wash and wear. That is never, I feel like if you said, what were we like when I was a senior in high school and I was the oldest, whether it is, and like it is today, it's the same. And I think that's just, I'm really blessed for that. That's an amazing thing just to say it out loud. I appreciate the question.
Yeah.
Am I up now?
Yeah.
Guys, all
hey,
right.
Sean.
Well, Steve, how are you doing? You look great. You made
doing
it
great.
Feel bad because we were, yeah. You know, we're like, what's he doing? Oh, he's working out. Of course he is. Keep staying in great shape.
Don't let that fool you, John. It has been difficult to get out and work out, so it was a little bit of an anomaly. But I'm grateful that you called me right then. It makes me look good.
No, it's great. Before I ask my question, similar to one that Chad teed up, let me just say I've had the privilege of interviewing some global celebrities, some leaders of nations, and I know I'm supposed to just act like we're professionals here doing this, but there's this fanboy side of me that's just got to tell you what a thrill and honor it is to be on here with you. I know I speak for millions around the world who just followed you your entire career. You've been such an incredible ambassador for so many things, for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, for Brigham Young University, for NFL teams and your family, and just thrilled to be here with you, and thank you for being such a nice guy, just so genuine and not changing. Let me ask then, Chad brought it up and you alluded to it. You talked about your mom and her influence, some of the characteristics of being a peacemaker. Amongst all of this COVID craziness and earthquakes and missionaries coming back from around the world, I lost my dad after a couple year battle with cancer just a few days ago. And he was my hero. And he came across, from another country to escape political turmoil with nothing, live the American dream. But he was always such an optimist. He would say, son, if you wake up in this country with your family and your health, everything else is gravy. Implying that if you were here, you have freedoms that are protected. And right. As long as you could get up, you could get on your knees and pray to God, thank him, and then go out and work your tail off like you meant it, and your family was safe. Whether it's from your dad, another parental figure, you talked about mom already, what characteristic or attribute could you share that in troubled times, when times get really tough, where there's turmoil, that has helped you throughout your playing career, your broadcast career, just life in general?
Well, Sean, I appreciate that. That's kind of you to say. It's very meaningful to me, especially as I get older. I remember when I was playing for the 49ers and feeling like I didn't want to let down. I mean, I was the only LDS kid in my high school of 3,000. I knew what if – someone who was LDS playing pro football, what if I, what influence it would have been on me. So I just always had that in my mind, and I always had that in my heart that I didn't want to. I didn't want anything phony about it. I just want to sincerely not do anything that would, Roger Staubach was my hero. He never did anything to disappoint me. I always told him, I've told him now we're friends. We're good friends, which is an amazing story in itself. And how grateful I was that he did things to pay it forward for me. And now I'm trying to pay it forward for others. So when you say that those nice things about me, it is meaningful. And I appreciate that. And I'm sorry to hear about your dad. My father's 84. He's had some heart issues and he's battled through them. And I told him he has to put 110 in his mind, you have to go for it. He's the kind of guy that could, his nickname is Grit and he means it. And I think he could probably grit his teeth and do that. But we recognize that every day is a blessing. And I think for me, I've always had a sense of heavenly connection in my life. I've taken the gospel of Jesus Christ kind of it's meant to be individual and personal, and it's been very personal to me. I was a kid and I remember reading the promises of the section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants talking about the word of wisdom, and I thought to myself, I just lived that. I said I'll always be able to run and be strong. Those have been very literal things for me. And so I have a lot of literal takes on the promises that Christ made. I'm the light and the life. I mean, that's literal to me. And so I when I'm in a tough time, when I'm really down, even recently, some tough times, just trying to figure out what my next step is, challenges that I'm in. And I think what I constantly do is just think to myself, Steve, practice your religion. What is that? And what is, if I had to put it very simply, there's four qualities that I think that we're meant to work on to, have in our hearts. And they are long suffering, gentle persuasion, love unfeigned, and meekness. And so for a football player, those are not power words. Those are not words that exude like strength and power. But in human being, inner personal relationships, it is the secret. I've used it in my marriage. I've used it with my kids. I've used it my whole life. How do I more fully live these qualities? And so whenever I'm in a jam, it could be a jam at work. It could be a jam at home. It could be a mistake that was made. It could be conflict. It could be, I don't care what it is. If I say to myself, live your religion, what is the long-suffering place here? What would long-suffering mean to this situation? What would meekness mean to this situation? What would love mean to this situation? And then if I lay those on top of whatever it is, I swear the things just start to come more clear. And so I've just, I remember it was a Parley P. Pratt when he turned to Brigham Young when they got in the argument. And Brigham Young said to him, well, I guess you're going to leave the church now. And Parley, this is not perfect rendition, but Parley turns to him and says, I would leave it if it was your church, but it's my church and I'm staying. Right. And so for me, religion is super personal. It's super individual. And I think that's what Joseph Smith brought forward, is a very intimate, personal God that had been lost through the creeds. And so for me, that kind of exudes in what I do. And I don't mean to be overly religious about this. I really don't. I mean to tell you how I think about this junk and this crazy and the wacky stuff that goes on every day. And you ask me the question, what are the things? How do you do it? And I just kind of keep going back. I've been pushed to the corner many times. And so I know this works because it's kind of like when the barnacles are all power washed off your boat. You know what I mean? It's like you get refreshed and you get what really matters. And so I'm grateful for those things because now I feel like I have my arsenal. What are the things that I have that I can take with me every day? And I got those four qualities that that I think to myself, if this situation had more long suffering, what would that look like? And then, man, I'm telling you, the answers start to flood in, you know, because you know what it is. Usually, Sean, you want, not only do you want to win it, you know better. I'm stronger. I know I've been right all along, or I've been, you know, and it just, you right. lay these things yeah. on top of you like, ooh, this one's going to be tougher than I thought. And so anyway, sorry to ramble, but I really appreciate the question. It's super meaningful right now. I think we're all in a really strange state right now. Not strange, in a really reflective state. Things that, if you would have said a year ago on the podcast, in 1 year, we're all going to be sheltered throughout the country. There's going to be an international, worldwide pandemic. Hundreds of thousands of people are going to die. There's no sports. Everything's shut down. And you'd say to yourself, oh my gosh, it's the end of the world. And here we are living it out and having to figure out what's the next step. I think there's a unique opportunities as we do this podcast on how to be better on the backside of this pandemic. And if I could do one thing and have my kids have one thing to go with them, it would be those four qualities. So I just give you that as my, it's not my secret sauce, but it's been my secret sauce through a lot of years. Sorry for roaming, rambling.
No, it's great. And I have a quick follow on, even though I'm going to preempt Chad, who's patiently waiting because he knows I have 42 questions. But you made mention of one thing that I wanted to just touch on, because that was actually question number 17 for me. You had talked about expectations that other people had of you not wanting to disappoint them. I think that's a noble aspiration. But there's also a time in your life that you decide, look, whether or not people think I should go on a mission or not, they don't know my situation. Whether or not my career is validated if I win a Super Bowl or not. Unfortunately, for all of us, you did. But how do you stay focused on what you need to do, what's between you and God and Barb and the importance, without giving into people's hopes and expectations? Because it's a balance. You still want to, you want to fulfill that role. To me, it's always been, you've done such a good job of striking that balance. Can you give us some insight into what you think about?
Yeah. It's really important. You say it very well, because you can't play one key on the piano. You might be the greatest one key piano player ever, but you got to have a lot of ways to do it. I've said that I call it spiritual athleticism. And you bring up all the ironies that Christ taught. The last shall be first. Lose yourself and find yourself. There's all these ironies that create a sense of dynamic. And so when you say trying to please everybody, the most dramatic example of that was when I replaced Joe Montana. Now, remember, I replaced Jim McMahon, and Chad's not old enough for this, so he'll have to read the book. But I visited him in his second grade class when I was in college. And
I was sixth grade. I'll never forget
grade,
it.
Sixth grade. Anyway, I replaced Joe, and he was the king. And I just remember that, you can say that's easy to say, I replaced Joe Montana, but the actual living it out and then living it out with your teammates, everyone. I mean, honestly, I couldn't get in the car. I remember getting in the car after practice, turning on the radio, and within 5 minutes, someone on the radio was either the guy that was, then finally I said, look, I'm going to listen to easy listening. There's no way they're going to talk about Steve Young on Easy Listening Radio. And then and then Barry Manilow would finish his song and then be like, hey, about Steve Young, man, he is just not Joe Montana. And I'm like, geez. And just can somebody, I'd be on at the line at the grocery store and the guy in front of me, Steve Young, he just can't do it, And then your teammates and everybody's staring at you. And it felt like everyone alive in the whole world was staring at me saying, you're not Joe Montana. And then I was doing everything I possibly could do. Every inch of myself was poured into trying to be Joe Montana. And it just finally dawned on me. It got so bad. I mean, I got into a hole. I got depressed. I got anxiety ridden. I could hardly sleep. I was miserable. I'd go to practice and be miserable. I'd come home and be miserable. I was victimized. I was feeling like everything, the world was out to get me. I remember I got to a game when we played the LA Raiders. They were in Los Angeles. We played in the Coliseum and we lost 9-3 or something. It was terrible. The last play of the game, Jerry Rice is open in the end zone and I don't see him and I get sacked and we lose. And it was the lowest of the low for me as a professional, but then just as a human being, it's like it all just caved in right there. And I remember the next day I said, I got to get out of here. And I flew to Salt Lake to be with my brother who was in med school at the U at the time. And I walked around Salt Lake City with him and I said, Mike, I'm not going to make it. I can't sleep. I'm depressed. I'm in a hole and I'm mad and I'm angry at myself. I'm angry at the world. I don't know how I'm getting out of this. I still got 10 weeks of the sea. I'm not going to make it. He told me, I know Mike, he said, look, Steve, I got two kids and I'm broke and I'm just trying to get through med school. So, you know, you got to know you'll be all right. But then I got on the plane to go home. And I sat next to Steve Covey, and stop me if you've heard this story, but I sat next to Steve Covey, and I knew him, but I didn't know him, like, to speak to him and have a conversation. And I'll go through this story really quickly because it changed my life. He said, I immediately when I sat down, he goes, how you doing? And that I just gave him everything I had, you know, for the first 15 minutes of the flight and just how terrible it was. And I finished and he looked me in the eye. You know, he was bald and he kind of had older and he didn't look, I'm not going to say he was Yoda because he looked like Yoda. I'm saying he was Yoda in the way he spoke. You know, he would look at me in the eye and he'd be like, so Steve, I hear you, but tell me, Eddie DeBartolo, he's a great owner. Yeah. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's the greatest. He thinks every player and owners are partners. He's brought everyone together. It's a family. It's amazing. And Bill Walsh, he's a great coach too, isn't he? He goes, yeah. And Bill Walsh is forward thinking. He's amazing. And he goes, yeah, I'd love to meet those guys. They sound great. And then Joe Montana's on the team, right? And I said, yeah, that's the problem. Aren't you hearing me? And he goes, well, if you had to ask him a question as a mentor, could you ask him a question? And he said, yeah, I could ask him a question. But, you know, he goes, then he stopped me and he looked me in the eye. He goes, Steve, I got to be honest with you. I travel the world looking for platforms for where human beings can have the opportunity to iterate and see how good they can get. And when I see those platforms, whether it's corporations, families, organizations, I want to elevate them and amplify them so that the whole world knows, because every human being deserves a great platform to see how good they can be. And I got to be honest, I've traveled the whole world, Steve. I don't know if I've ever seen anybody in such a good situation as you are to find out how good you can be. And I remember thinking the guilt that rushed over me that I'd allowed myself to fall into this hole of comparison, of failure, of all that stuff that just is such a weight. And to your point, Sean, it could be a brother that you don't want to, you can't own up to, or a friend, or some sense that I'm not good enough, or I'm not in comparison. And I look around the world and I'm always not good enough. And you can do that, and you can be like me and get into a huge hole. And then when Steve Covey told me that, my life changed right then in that moment. And my whole globe just went upside down. And he looked at me and just like Yoda with his finger, he goes, Steve, tell me, do you want to see how good you can get? And I remember thinking, you know, because he said, not everybody wants to. I mean, that's a hard thing to answer, but do you want to? And I go, yeah, I want to. He goes, well, then go do it. And that rest is history. But I needed to get out of that hole of comparison because I could have spent my whole life doing that. And luckily, I had that unique experience with Steve Covey.
Beautiful. Very profound. Thank you. Chad?
Yeah, you're a warrior. You're a lifter. You've always operated from the perspective that faith is the engine that drives it all. I remember riding up the ski lift to Snowbird when you talked about faith is the engine. You've quietly made a mission of your life to helping or lifting young people who are struggling with depression or even thoughts of suicide. And I want you to describe the effect that this ministering has had on your spirit, on your soul.
Yeah. I really have to say, I'm married up. My wife, Barb, has a reflexive love for people who are, my alarm seems to be having trouble. reflexive love for those that are marginalized, people that, whether it's LGBT community, whether it's just, you know, anyone that might be suffering, struggling. And I think for me, that's been a real light for me to recognize and to see people and to stop and listen to their stories. You know, those of us that have been baptized in the LDS Church, we make a covenant right then at that time that we will walk with others and we will carry their burdens and we will share with them in a way that's selfless. It's not transactional. It's not, I'm going to help you because then you'll help me, or I'm going to help you because then God will bless me, or I'm going to help you for some kind of return. I learned from Barb that there's just a reflexive, I'm here for you. I'd like to see you not suffer so much. I'd like to, let me learn about you. What's your life like? Let me walk with you. Let me hold your hand for a moment and live in your shoes. And that has been one of the great blessings of my life. And I'm telling you this because I'm just learning how to do this. But the secret, in my mind, the secret to life is to leave a transactional relationship with people and especially with God to a non-transactional relationship where you just seek others' healing. You seek others' peace. You seek, and you're not looking for something back. Think about Mother Teresa as she goes into the slums in India. She's not looking for anything. She's just giving, give, 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 give. Forgiving, forgiving, forgiving. Lose yourself and find yourself. You know, all those things come rushing back when you lose the transaction. And I think that's really resonated with me on how to try to, you know, and it's harder in business. It's harder out in the more complex things in life, but it's still a North Star. You know, what you walk into a business meeting and you think, if you walk in and you say to yourself, I'm going to watch for places where I can be a healing influence in this room. It might be a smile. It might be a howdy hello. It might be, or it might be not getting into a conflict or how to avoid the conflict or how to settle the conflict, how to be forgiving 70 times seven, how to turn the other cheek when those that despitefully use you. Ever thought about that? Someone's despitefully using you and you're supposed to turn away. I mean, it's amazing what we're asked to do, but those are the things that are really my North Star that I've learned. And I'm grateful to my wonderful wife to teach me these beautiful concepts, because I find myself wanting to be a healer. Like, where can I find healing? And not because I get something back, but the unique thing about it, Chad, is that, and I don't mean this to be a Sunday school lesson, but it's like my business life is this now. This is what I think about in the companies, in work, talking to the CEOs and how to be, they always like, how am I better CEO? What can I do better? And these concepts resonate with these CEOs in leadership. And how can I give? And how can I create a better environment? How can I make my employees more productive? How can I, all those things come back to this kind of non-transactional experience. And if you think about it, not to go too far, and I'm sorry about this, but you guys put me on Zoom and now I got to keep talking because I obviously don't get a chance to talk very often. But if you read Moroni 7, it's charity. If you think about charity is, it's selflessness. It's to lose yourself, seeking others' goodness. And that's true in business. It's true in your families. It's true on the street. I find myself, thanks to your question, contemplating all the time how to be less transactional, looking for something back, and more truly selfless. Like I just want you to, I want to bring you peace and healing. Anyway, that's that.
Steve, thank you for that. You know, Elder Ballard talked about that transition away from transactional relationships in a seminal conference talk, talked about the gospel of inclusion or the doctrine of inclusion. And he said this, which has always stuck with me, pure Christian service is an end unto itself. So the reason you're doing it, that's the reward. That's the motivation. You've not only said it well, but knowing how you live your life, exemplify that. I'm going to follow Chad's lead. Apparently, he wasn't just a great receiving tight end for the Eagles. He could block a little bit, too. So I'm just going to kind of follow behind. He keeps bringing up great questions. He talked about some of what you've done for youth, including your Forever Young Foundation. Since 1993, helping to bring some of the most vulnerable children opportunities, hope, light in their lives. You and I, the last time we were together, we chatted a little bit about the epiphany that I had, an experience going out with Tim Ballard and Operation Underground Railroad.
Yes, Tim. Good friend.
Some little kids from child sex trafficking. And then me being confronted with that in the state of Utah and prosecuting cases here of human trafficking, opening up my eyes to this horror, but also dealing with the innocent children who it changed my life in many ways. Even though I still am involved in so many other things, that was one thing that has created a cause in my heart, has created a mighty change in my heart to want to always help on that front. Can you think of an experience throughout your career? And I know that you've had so many around the world where you had kind of that aha moment where you saw something that was so moving that it motivated you to stay committed to that cause or to do something about it for the rest of your life, the rest of your career. Could it be a charity? It could just be a story a person that you interacted with. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And even Forever Young, so much good work there.
Yeah, yeah. I once, the first year I was at BYU, Marie Osmond and John Schneider started what is now Children's Miracle Network. They've been at it for now 35 years, almost 40 years. The first one was up at Primary Children's Hospital. And as a BYU football player, I was invited up to be a part of this inaugural effort. And I'd never been sick. I'd never been hurt. I'd never been in the hospital. And so here I was, 18, 19 years old. And I go up to the Primary Children's Hospital, and it was a shock to me. I know that sounds goofy for people, but I was shocked to see kids suffering. Like, oh my gosh, this is, like, I guess it, theoretically I'd known that there was trauma and drama in the world, but I think for me, to see the suffering and its extent. And I remember meeting a young boy who had epidermolysis bullosa. It's the most terrible thing that you could, I mean, I'm not going to compare. It was so terrible. The genetics are missing to connect your skin to your body. It like sloughs off. And so you end up scarring in every place that your body bends. It's a scarring and mummifying. And honestly, I couldn't respond. I took my breath away. And this boy who had EB, they call it, who was half mummified, and I'm 18 years old, I'm coming up to try to help this cause, to try to raise money for Children's Hospital, and I'm looking at him, and they're like, Steve, this is, and I say, how are you doing? And he looks back at me straight in the eye, goes, I'm doing great. And I said to myself, oh my gosh, you're not doing great. You're not doing great. And I just remember that spirit that he had. That no matter what, I'm in this, and I'm in a really tough spot, but I am hopeful, and I am here to give you. It's almost like he was lifting me. I know it sounds strange. And so that was one seminal experience. Another one came about 7 years ago. I was invited up, Barb and I, to speak for Affirmation, which is the LGBT kind of LDS organization. And they have an annual conference up in, they have it in Provo, but it was in Salt Lake this year, the year that I did it. And I spoke and Barb spoke, and Barb just, you know, there's just a love that she's a, you know, not a superstar, but she's just somebody, the beloved person in that environment. And so as it ended, all the LGBT kids came. And everyone of sort of kind of surrounded Barb, and they you know, oh my gosh. And I, for the first time in my life, not first time, but part that I really enjoy, I'm kind of on the outskirts, kind of just watching this and appreciating the love that, and the healing that, that she had brought to these people. And I sat on the outside, and one by one, these young men, obviously returned missionaries, and essentially the same story, would come up to me and, "Hey, Steve, would you mind if I took a picture with you? Because my dad and I, we're not really doing well. And I know he loves you. And if I was in a picture with you, I bet you that it would help our relationship." And that happened 5, 6, maybe 10 times in the next 20 minutes, where these young boys, men, were looking for healing from their own family with a picture. And I think what little it was to do to wrap my arm around them, tell them I love them, and make sure that I tell your dad hello. And it just reminded me that there's a lot of stories out there and a lot of healing to be done and stuff that I've never really seen and been a part of. And the LGBT community, for me, since knowing my wife and really the last 15 years, have given them me the most warm spiritual experiences, have brought the gospel more clearly and more purely to my heart. And so those are the things, you know, if you ask me those couple of things, those are the things that continue to move me and remind me that, you know, I'm many more times given more than I'm giving. And so I'm just, I remain very humble around anything that I've ever done to help, because the spirit, this fighting spirit of that young boy, the EB, and my dear brother, my LGBT brothers and sisters, I just, there's something there, Sean, that I just want to be a positive part of. And now I'm 35 years later, I'm still with Children's Miracle Network. We're still doing the same things. They bring in kids from every state once a year, and these kids inevitably, as they introduce them, there's a boy or a girl with crutches, with legs that aren't strong enough to carry them, and they don't want to go on stage with crutches, so they'll throw them down. They'll jam their knees together to brace themselves, and then they'll climb and crawl their way up on stage because they don't want to be on stage with crutches. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, inspiration. So anyway, enough of that. I'm obviously been inside too long.
No, this is
but
great.
But these are the
this
things. Great. I'm so grateful for a chance. These are the things I think about night and day. So I'm grateful to have a chance to chat with you guys and have an outlet, to be honest with you, because your questions have gotten me a little bit. I wasn't ready for those kind of questions, so I'm grateful.
Well, we're only hitting about halftime, right, guys? Because you said we could stay on as long as Steve's good.
Well, I've got a question. This COVID-19 is going to cause a lot of transitions for a lot of people, and you made a transition out of the NFL into the business world. You've been successful, whatever you've done. And I know it's not easy. I know that there's things that probably got you through it. So maybe talk about that. Talk about that, leaving the NFL, starting a new life in the business world and making it work.
Yeah. The first thing is humility. You have to truly start over. I remember waking up the next day, and Chad, you've had this experience where the day before I was one of the best or one of the more proficient in the world at something. You know, someone said, "Hey, in all the world, how do you rank as a football player?" I'm like, "I'm pretty good." And the next day, you're not good at anything. The one thing you're really good at is gone. And then what else are you really good at? Nothing. What are you even kind of good at? Not very much. In fact, I'm not good at, I mean, honestly, what are you? And so there's a humility that you have to have, that like, I am going to start over. And I'm grateful for the experience that I had. There are many mentors. Bob Gay is one of my mentors in business. Larry Sonsini and Wilson Sonsini, one of the great lawyers here in Silicon Valley. While I was on the board early on and while I was still playing at Power Bar, if you can believe it, was my first business experience, where he and Warren Hellman tutored me in I never thought about business. I was going to be a lawyer. And so that really made a big difference in my transition. And so I think being willing to start over and not walk around like, oh, hey, I was really good at something. Give me credit. No. You have to start over. And so that's a big part. But I think that there's a lot that you can carry with the experiences. So much I weigh on. And I think about what we're in the middle of COVID-19 right now, Chad. And what's the most fascinating part of it is you talk about transitions. Think about what's happened. 75%, and really most of America right now, but 70, at least, you know, hundreds of millions of people have gone in their homes, yes, to stay healthy. But what is the fundamental principle behind why everyone's doing it? It's to prevent the most, you know, the most at risk population. We know that this COVID-19 is something that risks the elderly and the people that have underlying health issues. And so in many ways, we're going inside our homes to protect the most vulnerable. And I think there's something to that, that as humanity, we can say to ourselves, we can do hard things. Yes, to benefit ourselves. There's some transaction there based on what we were talking about before. But there's also fundamentally because we want to make sure that the most vulnerable are protected. And I have something to build off of there. And I think that this COVID-19 could be a real change agent for how we see each other. It could actually go the other way too. We got to be careful that we don't become tribal and become watch out for, oh, you're dangerous. You might have the COVID-19 or we got to be careful. But what we've fundamentally done is something really, I think, really inspiring. That we've gone kind of indoors to protect the most vulnerable. And so I think two things for me is the humility to make the transition and then the leadership that we need to have. And I think the real leadership that we saw early on was from the private sector, from the schools at Stanford, at Harvard. We saw it from the Silicon Valley companies that saw that the data. And it was the private sector in many ways that led the way, private people saying to themselves, you know what, we see this and we got to do something about it. And I really appreciate that leadership.
All right. I'm going to talk about football for a second because I know there's some listeners who are probably like, great guys. You got, a couple guys, NFL Hall of Famer, former NFL star, and they haven't talked football yet, and then me. So I'm going to preface it by saying one thing you mentioned that you married up. Lewis and I have a club we started called the Married Up Club. When you marry far above your
station,
and knowing Barb well, I think you are you should be a charter member. We'll waive your membership fee. You can just come on in.
Hey, Sean. Sean, the football there, metaphor for that is outkicking your coverage. I outkicked my coverage on that one.
Yeah, you Ray guy punted that like you just way yeah. Outkicked that. So let's talk a little bit of football. But let me set the stage this way because I want to talk about maybe some of your greatest achievements that came. I think people looking back just remember the Super Bowl win and the iconic monkey off the back, but they didn't realize a lot of the other stuff that was going on there. I had a front row seat to that because I had taken your lead. I was in law school, had some eligibility left at Cal, was playing for Cal, not football, but Tom Homo was our, who played with you at BYU 49ers. He was the defensive coordinator. Kalani Sitake was a missionary serving his mission there on campus, which was the worst draw that you could ever get, but somehow Kalani was excited about it. You put on epic firesides for us with Bart Oates and guys like Jesse Sapolu that you brought. It was this incredible, time for us.
Yeah,
we were such big fans. By the way, you didn't even know me. I was just a law student, and you were as nice to me as you were when you signed my autograph when you were playing for BYU. As you've always been. That's why I say, for a super duper star, an icon, you're the nicest guy, and we appreciate that. But here's what people don't realize: that in that 95 season, where you, everyone said, validated yourself and finally proved that you were the successor to the Hall of Famer Montana, it wasn't easy pickings, and it wasn't smooth sailing all the way either. You had some tough losses that year, including, to Kansas City and Joe. I think Philadelphia, St. Louis is an Eagle. That wasn't a pretty picture. Yep. I was screaming at Seifert and everybody else, because you're my guy, and you could have you could have done anything, and I would have been defending you. And then after all of that turmoil, you get to the Super Bowl, you throw 6 touchdowns, a record, 325 yards, all that. It's incredible, but I think people only remember that. And I would love for you to unpack that season a little bit, or talk about some of the maybe the coolest things that happened, or some of the toughest things that happened for all the big football fans out there who watched your career.
Well, you gotta put it in context, Sean. We'd in 1992, coming off of the Steve Covey conversation in 1991, and changing my life. I only say this to give context. In 1992, I was MVP of the NFL, and the only way that could have happened out of the deep hole that I was in was perspective that I got from Steve Covey. And we go to the championship game and get beat by this upstart Dallas Cowboy team that was not supposed to win. And so not only do I get beat in a championship game against the Dallas Cowboys, but we were supposed to win and we were home. And so then the next year we go to Dallas and get beat again in the championship game in 93. So now 2 years in a row, you're talking about the Joe Montana thing looming out there. Now I had already overcome it. I was done with in one fell swoop, I was done with the comparisons. I was on a quest to see how good I can get. And so that was it really worked. That's all I had focused on. It's like, how good can I get at this? And so I wasn't burdened, but I knew that I was like, regardless, we'd gotten beaten twice. You remember that? I mean, it was a tough time. 94 comes. It looks like the Cowboys are going to three-peat. The Cowboys are going to three-peat right over my, like with truck, with tire marks right over my face. And so we play that season like in, I'm not saying desperation, but it has to not happen again. So 3 things happened. One, we played Joe Montana in Kansas City, and that was just the drama of all dramas, and got beat in the last couple of minutes. And I remember saying after the game, I guess I got more to learn from the king. I mean, I just wanted to move on, right? It was, and then we got beat badly at home against Philadelphia, where I got in the only argument I've ever really been in, true, true argument, was a one-way argument with me and George Seifert, the head coach, because I felt like he embarrassed me, and I was sick of being embarrassed by how he pulled me out of the game, and like I just felt like he pointed the finger. I took it very, 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 very personally, and I remember just screaming at him on the sidelines and trying to get into a fight. I said things to him that I would never say to another human, to have him turn around and turn. I wanted to fight. I'd never been like that my whole life. And to his credit, he just stared straight ahead. And the whole game, I kept this up. And then, to the end of the game, and then in the locker room, I told everybody, you better get him in here. I am not leaving until he confronts me. And George just left and left me just sitting there with my own soup, and to just suck it up. And I look back on that and so grateful for George to be mature when someone mature needed to be there, because I was looking for a fight. And if he was looking for a fight, there would have been a fight. But he was the better man. And so that was the 2 losses. And then we won a bunch of games in a row, including beating the Cowboys at home, which was a big deal because they'd beaten us twice in the championship game, and now we got to show that we can beat them. And we beat them at home. And then, of course, we get them in the championship game that year again. So now we're championship game loss, championship game loss, championship game, 3rd year in a row, at home again. And if we get beat here, Sean, I should just get in the car and take 80 across the Bay Bridge and then just Vallejo, you know, Nut Tree, Sacramento, Auburn, Tahoe, Reno, and just go. Like, do not come home. Do not come back. Just go find another city to play in. Just be done with this madness. So there was a lot riding on that game. And I remember early in the game, Eric Davis intercepted Troikman and returned for a touchdown. We got a couple of touchdowns early, and we got a lead. And then they fought back. And right before half, I threw a long ball to Jerry Rice in the back corner of the end zone that he caught. It was a muddy, muddy game. I remember him catching it and sliding like 15, 20 feet, you know, just out of the end zone. The referees had to gather, and they saw that his feet literally had, they knew he was in bounds because his feet had, you could see the drag marks the whole way in the mud marks that was in bounds. They had to recreate the line of the end zone because it was all marred. They recreated and go, oh, he was in bounds. And that was a lead we needed at halftime. They did fight back and got within 10. And then I ended up running for a touchdown and falling into the end zone, and it made us 38-21, I want to say, with about 5 minutes left. And I spiked that ball, Sean.
You didn't fall into the end zone. You powered into the end zone.
I know, but I remember spiking that ball as hard as I could. I mean, I'm like, this is going to happen. This is happening.
I loved it.
And I remember at the end of that game, it was very similar to how I felt as a junior. I replaced Jim McMahon and all that stuff that goes on with 73 NCAA records. And I remember we were at the U, at Rice-Eccles Stadium, and we'd beaten the U. And now we were going to the Holiday Bowl, which is what you do at BYU. And that's what a quarterback's supposed to do, is get him to the Holiday Bowl. And we'd won the WAC and done all that stuff that I didn't think it was ever possible that I could do. If you kind of look at you look yourself in the mirror and you're like, I'm a fraud. There's no way I'm good at this. You know, and that moment, I remember walking off the Rice-Eccles Stadium. The snow had started to fall, and it was the most beautiful. I mean, like, every time I say it, I can be there right now. I'm there. I can smell it. I can feel it. I can taste it. I can do everything about what I can. I see every step. I see every person. I can feel it. And that relief and that sense of accomplishment, that sense of all of those things that go into that, was that same feeling I had of that championship game, when it was just like, oh, just this just release. And I remember I started running around the stadium, high-fiving the fans, and I lost my mind. And it was the most free, pure moment I've ever had in my life, where I didn't know where I was. It was like, if you said to me, what were you thinking? I was like, I have no idea. I have no idea. It just was, it was the most beautiful moment. So that one, you know, and that wasn't even the Super Bowl, but that got me to the Super Bowl. And then obviously I'll give you one quick moment in the Super Bowl. It was a pregame. Mike Shanahan, my coach, my offensive coordinator, I used to call Mike, let's go over it again, Shanahan. And he would go over it again. Like, he'd come into the locker room right before the game. Let's go over it again. Let's go over it again. I'm like, Mike, I can't go over it again. So he comes in before the Super Bowl. And the Super Bowl, everything's longer. The pregame's longer. And so we came in. We had like 15 minutes before we were going to get introduced. And I knew what he was going to do. He was going to go over it again. He wants to go over it again, right? So I'm like, oh, but it's a Super Bowl. I'm like, okay, maybe we better go over it again. So we took the 15 minutes. We go over it again and go through the game plan and everything else. I have it memorized in my mind. I'm just spitting it out to him. And he's just checking it, check, 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 check. And then he finishes and he goes, Steve, we're going to kill him. And you're going to throw 8 touchdowns. And I go, 8 touchdowns? Wow. We came in to halftime. We came into halftime with 4. And he looked me in the eye. He goes, I told you, you're going to get 8. And so we had 6. Through the 6th touchdown with about a minute into the fourth quarter, we had still 14, 15 minutes left in the game. And George pulls me out of the game, you know, because we're up by so much. He's like, you're coming out of the game. And I tell George, you can't pull me out of the game. Mike's going to be so mad because he wants 8 touchdowns. He has to have 8 touchdowns. And I go get on the phone with Mike, who's up in the booth. And I go, Coach, amazing. You know, well, congratulations. We won the Super Bowl. This is great. He goes, get in the game. We got to get 8. I told you about that 8. And I guess the lesson for that one is that if you want to throw 6 touchdowns in a football game, you better intend to throw 8. You know what I mean? That's the let. Like, that's the, like, he wanted 8, and so he got 6. 6 is more than anyone's ever heard of in the history of man. No one's ever thrown 6 touchdowns in a Super Bowl. That's nuts. maybe once or twice in the history of the game has someone thrown six touchdowns in a game. Like, that's unheard of. And then in a Super Bowl, but if you want to throw six, go for eight. You know, that's the lesson there. So
I love it.
And then the great stuff that happened after that game, and oh my gosh, that was the best. Never got back, Sean. Never got back. Got back to a championship game or two. Had good teams.
Four guys.
You think you're going to get back a bunch of times, and they just don't get back. And it's a really special thing. I look back on, I was a part of like seven or eight championship games and three Super Bowls. And you think about that. I could have seven Super Bowl wins, right? It's like 49ers in 20 years were a part of eight championship games and won three Super Bowls. But what about the other five? You know what I mean? Like not to be greedy, but, you know, hey, we were right there.
Here's my last question. I was going to ask about Tom Brady and his nine Super Bowls and six wins and moving to Tampa Bay, but you had a moment with Andy Reid after this year's Super Bowl. He won it. And here are you guys talking as friends. You've known him forever. You've known the ups and the downs and the behind the scenes, the work. And for me, watching it with my family in my living room, it was so sweet watching you guys talk and banter and your friendship and football and everything. Just talk about that just for a second.
It was a special moment. And excellence, Bill Walsh used to say, excellence was setting up base camp at Everest. That's excellence. And then you attack the summit. You're not going to get there every time. But excellence is getting to base camp. And so I always thought about that. I thought excellence was only if you got to the top of Everest. And I always thought about that because Andy has always been excellent.
Yeah.
He's always set up base camp. He's always around the playoffs. He's always been a part of excellence, but he'd never been to the summit. And like anybody, it's got to be part of it. Like, you want that to be a part of it. And if it's not, you feel a little bit of a hole, right? And even though you appreciate everything you've accomplished and all the blessings and everything you've gotten, you want to be there. And you knew Andy remember, he was my JV coach at BYU. I was a freshman quarterback. He was the JV coach graduate as the GA assistant, because he just graduated. He was my JV coach. And we went to Air Force as a BYU JV. And we were trading off. There's three quarterbacks on JV: Mark Calgo, myself, and Jim Kimble. The three of us were the JV quarterbacks. And everyone got to start. We traded off. So if I started, then Jim would start. Then Mark would start. And so it got to be Air Force. We go over to Colorado Springs to play Air Force's JV in front of three people. And one of the persons that's in the crowd is Mark Calgo's dad. And Mark Cargo's dad had flown in from Minnesota to see the game. And he came in before the game and said to me, "Steve, I know it's your turn to start, but Mark Cargo's dad is here. Do you mind if he gets the start?" And I told Andy, and we laughed about it, even at that moment after the game. I said, "Hey, Coach, there's no way I'm not starting. You tell Mark Cargo's dad that he's going to see one heck of a performance from me, all right, because I'm going to be good. I'm going to be great." And so it just reminded me, because I remember Andy when he was walking towards me with Tammy, his wife, and I'd seen that excellence through the years with Andy and all the things that he'd done and the beloved person that he was in the NFL. I mean, when I would go in ESPN and I would go around people at ESPN or around people in the NFL offices or around other coaches or around other players, and you said the word name Andy Reid, reflexively, everybody says, "I love that guy."
Yeah.
I love that guy. He did more to bring – we talk about healing. We talk about non-conflict. We talk about bringing peace to an organization. Andy Reid was a peacemaker in the NFL for 25 years. And so now all of a sudden, he'd reached the summit. He got the thing that was so elusive. It doesn't matter. You don't have to have it to be excellent. But my gosh, when you get there, it is something super special. And I remember him walking towards me with Tammy, and we met eyes, and all of a sudden we were back as JV coach and GA, man. We were like, we've been through this. for 30 years, 40 years. And I hugged him and I said, Andy, I just don't, and we just tears, you know, just tears for what he was feeling. And just to be a part of it. Look, I did nothing to help him win the championship. I did nothing for the Kansas City Chiefs, but to be a part of it, to be around it, and to be, as we interviewed him in post game, it was really one of my neat memories. So yeah, I appreciate that, Chad. And I apologize, guys. I'm sitting there talking into my phone. I'm at my house. I have no idea how long we've been doing this. I'm sorry to chat so much, but obviously we got some time on our hands.
Love every second of it.
We're okay. So we're in the fourth quarter now, beginning. I think Lewis stole my playbook because every question I had, he asked first. So good job. I'm glad you talked about Coach Reed, because you said it well, Steve. It wasn't necessary to cement his legacy, but it was well-deserved validation, I think, for all of us who are fans of his.
For sure.
I'm going to ask you like a three-part question, Steve. You can answer any one of them or you can answer all of them. The first question has to do with coaching. You did play for Andy Reid. Is there a coach that you would have loved to have played for that, you know, whether it was during your time or an era past, that you always thought, man,
yeah,
if I had a chance to play for him. Question number two, talking about coaches, this young missionary, while you were winning NFL championships, was winning the hearts and souls of a lot of people on the Berkeley campus, a kid named Kalani Sitake. He was Elder Fifita at the time. I knew because I had to drive him around on splits and take his investigator to church. And he had the greatest approach. I said, you realize you've just been assigned to Sodom and Gomorrah. And he said, yep, more opportunity to baptize here. And such love and caring. I'd love for you to compare maybe some of the qualities that he has that reminds you of Coach Edwards just a little bit. I know they're very different.
Okay.
He's got better dance moves than Lavelle. But so that's question number two. I just love Kalani, and he's like a little brother. And then the last one, when you describe your almost euphoric feeling of winning the Super Bowl or previously in your junior year, just watching your pure joy is what makes, I think, sports so incredible for so many people, whether you play it or you just watch it or you commentate. In my world of politics, it is so divisive. Sports has a way of transcending, even though there's rivalries and even though there's competition, somehow sports has gotten us through 9/11, the aftermath of a lot of tragedies.
Yeah.
And even though we're not watching a lot of it, maybe share something about a time where sports helped you see it unify the human family or us as Americans, something like that. So lots of them. You can answer any one of them, none of them. You can talk about
I'll work backwards, Sean, because it comes in my mind. I remember Ronnie Lott. He got into a beef with Phil Sims once. Phil had said something a little, I didn't like it. It was in the heat of the moment publicly. And Ronnie was not somebody that didn't go over well with him. And so they had a beef. And it was a time. And when I just joined the 49ers in 1988, and the Giants were the big team and they just won the Super Bowl. And we were the big team because we were going to go to the Super Bowl. And we played him in San Francisco. And I remember Ronnie in pregame goes over to Phil and starts to lecture him on what it means to be a competitor and how the one thing that stuck in my mind is when he said, you don't understand, competition is a team game. And if you're going to get the most out of the competition, you have to be part of the team and you have to give that respect. You cannot disrespect or you lose an element of the competition and you devalue it. And I remember like, woof, Ronnie is living like he is bringing the heat here. And I still think about that. Competition is a team game. In other words, it is not a zero-sum game. You win, I lose, take it, stick it. But, you know, no, it is, we compete. We're holistic about it. There is a winner and loser, but there is a competition and respect. And then there's also a recognition that tomorrow I might be on the other side. And that you don't you because the truth is a zero sum game, Sean, and this is what the politics is today. It's a zero sum game. I win, and then the loser now feels completely, you know, abused.
Yeah.
So now they spend all their time battling back to that abusive feeling in an abusive way. And so all of a sudden now all you have is an abusive situation. You've got no team sense. And so that's why we have got to get out of that mess. Sports has got to get us out of this mess, because we have got to get a place where healers can say both sides have positions that we need to reason through and stop the zero-sum game. Zero-sum game is killing us. So no more. Hey, how's it going? How are you? Who is that behind you?
Yeah, what's your name? A future BYU player.
Attaboy.
Hey, so what's your name? Oh, I'm Aiden. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. So that's my thing about what sports and competition and what I remember about Ronnie Lott teaching me. And I've always thought about that. It eliminates the zero-sum game when you look at it as a team sport. You know, it's a part of, you know, we're all in it together. Back to Kalani and coaches. Think about my coaches. Lavelle Edwards, Mike Holmgren at BYU, Andy Reid at BYU. I go to the LA Express. It's John Hadle and Sid Gilman. Sid Gilman was the godfather of passing for the San Diego Chargers. Then I go to San Francisco with Bill Walsh, Mike Holmgren again, now that he's gone from BYU to San Francisco, Mike Shanahan, Steve Mariucci. I mean, like, oh my gosh, who would I have loved to play for? I think that's come to mind recently, these innovative coaches that have put you in the shotgun with the RPOs where you put it in the back and you just watch the safeties for like a good second and a half before you decide whether you want to do it or not. And then you let it go, you take it back, and now everyone's frozen and now people are just wide open. And you see what Sean McVay did and for the Rams, what Sean Payton's done for the Saints, what Kyle Shanahan did last year. When I was down with 49ers, I'm like, oh, I was a night before the game. He did installation. Bill Walsh always had the first 15. Now they do the first 20. And they tell the offense, these are the first 20 plays tomorrow. So everybody can go to bed and realize this is what we're going to run. And so that still is going on. So Kyle's going through the first 20, and he's going through it going, okay, and then Jimmy, I want you to do this. And I'm like, whoa, wait a second. First of all, that's not hard. But yet that's going to be really complex to the defense. And like, I want to play for you. Like, I want to do this. Like, part of me, like, I'm now 58 years old. I feel like I could go run those. I could do this. I could go play. And so I want, you know, these innovative coaches that have come from Andy Reid, that have come out of that, you know, from Bill Walsh to Mike Holmgren to Andy Reid, all of these coaches that are in the league today that have, they're the great grandsons of Bill Walsh. They are so innovative. Matt Nagy and, Doug Peterson and Kyle and Sean McVay and Pete Carroll came through here, even though he's older. But, I mean, these guys I would love to play for. I would love to play today in this environment with the offense the way it is. I'm super jealous. I'll admit it. I'm bitter that I wasn't born today. I mean, to play quarterback today for me, a guy that can run around and throw it, what I could have been, Sean. What I could have been. And then with Kalani, he is an anomaly. You do not find kindness. And, you know, he's an athlete. He's kind and intense, right? And he has to figure out how to manage that. But that kindness and intensity work at their creative tension. It's a tension that's creative. It can be toxic. You got to be careful. But he has an intensity and a kindness that are always at odds. And it can be really creative. And I think he's trying to find the most creative that he can be. I feel like the place that he's found the best is that he is an inspirational voice every day. He's an inspirational voice. And believe that. He needs to believe how inspirational he is. Just be that voice. and then you coach defense. You own that defense. I know that if he owns that defense, that we will have a top 20 defense in the league. And then now find somebody, you know, whoever's there or someone, I mean, whoever, and they are going to call plays aggressively to be BYU. We are going to be throwers of the football. We're going to be aggressive, and I'll have a defense that'll clean it up if we have problems. That's my Kalani and my take on BYU football. Okay.
Well, then if Lewis is already out, and that's fine. You know,
no, we got to end all the spirit strong. The spirit's in the room. Boom, we got to finish it.
let me ask you, on a really lighter note, because it's kind of surreal when you're a Hall of Famer and a legend. Have you ever played yourself in, you know, Madden or backyard football or any game going back? Because I used to always pick you, no matter what video game. I see you on there. So that's the light question.
Sean, that's a very interesting question, because I got to know the guys at EA. They had me do a little promotion for them, and my boys are all gamers. They love that stuff, and so I was interested in showing them EA Sports. So we went and visited them, and that got me to recognize, because I don't play Madden, but they showed me how I have these skill sets and numbers and speed and agility, and when I went through it, I'm like, no, that is not right. I am much faster than that. I have the time. I'll give you the 40 time. I'm like,
you're going to bring film for him?
I was like, this is not right. I am faster than that. I have my arm strength was like something. I'm like, no, that is not right either. And I had to, like, you need to go show. I was like, there's a throw that I did. Like, I was not going to live for that. That Madden did not resemble me. And so I went to battle, and I actually won. I'm over. I'm like, you're right. You show it, you know. And now I'm like super fast, you know. I got that. So I don't know. I every once in a while I'll get something that I'll see that some guy who plays Madden goes, Steve Young is super fast. Like he's like, I'm like, yes, that's right.
That's when the legal skills come in handy to be able to, you know, right. make your case. Right. Okay, here's my maybe last one. We want to be respectful of your time, and I got to thank Kurt and Dave for just giving us.
I got to cook dinner. This so yeah, we got. I got my. I'm on right. Dinner squad tonight.
Here we go. Then this is the last one. So again, you know, I was at your LA Express games, had your rookie card. You handled yourself with such incredible class there. Over the years, we've had some mutual friends. You may not remember when you were getting your .com company kicked off. I actually did legal work for you with Siebertson,
yes.
Jeff Steed over the years, Cam Tanner.
You're right. I knew I knew your name from a long time.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, it was.
I knew it.
Trust me.
I totally remember that.
I've been stalking you for your entire career and your entire life. my ex sports professor, a guy named Lee Steinberg, I helped Lee get back on his feet a few years ago, and you were kind enough to let us do.
Oh, you're great. You're great.
To do an ESPN reunion. That. Right before I became AG. But here's the question. All of them to a person have said one of Steve's many incredible characteristics and assets is his integrity. He has always been who he is, and it's been a strength to them. So this is coming from a guy like Steinberg who, you know, he knows every owner. He represented the greatest of the greats, Jerry Maguire, movie made about him. And tell me a little bit, just again, then maybe we started off deep and maybe you can come back to that just a little bit about it's hard in the NFL. It's hard when you're a broadcaster. It's hard no matter what situation you're in to stay true to your values and your principles. How do you do that? Because we're here with a management society and there's a lot of current leaders and future leaders who are listening to you about ethics and leadership. Maybe for my last question, you can talk about that, how you stay grounded.
And Lee, I'm so grateful you helped Lee. He actually was a great influence in my life. He was, when we joined forces, he was my agent and my lawyer coming out of college at BYU. And he was the one who told me, you're going to give back. And that's what started my Forever Young Foundation. Was Lee Steinberg. So that's now 30 years ago, 35 years ago, that we've been doing that work for kids. And Forever Young is thriving. And Lee was the one that, you know, showed me how to do that. So I appreciate that. And Sean, I'm glad that you helped him, because he's been through a lot of challenges and he's come out the other side as a warrior. And I appreciate what he's done. I think we talked a lot about my North Stars earlier. And I think that more than anything, I don't want to ever not be able to look someone in the eye. And so I'm somebody that if I leave a conversation and it didn't feel right, or I didn't say it the way I wanted to, or that there's some reason to, you know, kind of fix it. And maybe this is from my mother, because I told you she's a peacemaker. You don't want to just be a peacemaker. Again, that's why the gospel is such an interesting thing, because it takes spiritual athleticism. You can't just play one key. But one of the things that is a North Star is a peacemaker, and I do enjoy having that be I've always found it much more taxing, much more weighing, much more corrosive to be in conflict. I do not find energy in conflict. I find just the opposite. And so I think more than anything, and again, I guess maybe that's my mom, but I think that I seek common ground with people. I seek, in business, it's very complex things. But I will tell you, Sean, in the last 10 years, I've been doing private equity longer than I played football. I've been doing it for 20 years. The first 10 years was all the things you think about business. The second 10, everywhere I go, and it's everywhere, in companies and CEOs and employees, people are searching for a more holistic, emboldening, equitizing all the employees, how better to make partnerships, how better to make it an art project than a science project. And I just, I'm really amazed at the general tenor of the business climate that I'm around. I don't know if that's everywhere, but I sense that this is a generation that is saying, I'll take less as long as it's fair. And there's a fairness about it that I really, it gives me a lot of energy. And especially in our own little firm. I really appreciate that. And so I guess going back to your original question, we'll close on this. There's a piece that I seek. They don't always get it. I mean, right now, if you polled everyone that knows me, there'd be 15, 20% of people that I am not at peace with Steve Young right now. There are challenges, but the intent and the leaning, where we lean in towards peace. So that's our goal, right? It might not be today, but that's where we're headed, if that's fair, okay?
Thank you, brother.
You guys are great.
That was awesome. Good luck cooking. What are you guys eating tonight, if you're cooking?
For me, it's gonna be, I'm great. I can kill it with, I have a mash of eggs and potatoes and ham and sauces. And like, I'll do a big mash. I don't know if I'll do that tonight. I got a great, I'll do some salmon with mashed potatoes and broccoli. Broccoli is a standard in our home. Every meal has broccoli, because that's the one thing that everyone has to have. I hope that too much broccoli is not bad for you, because every meal starts with a handful of broccoli, because that's how the kids know it. Like, I can get something good if I'll eat my handful of broccoli.
Chopping broccoli.
I love you both. Sean, it's great.
Sean, Mahalo, brother.
My brother was a missionary. Jim was a missionary in Oakland while I was playing. And I swear to you, I knew you then. I don't know how. I remember you with Found. I remember you with Lee Steinberg. And I obviously know you as the EG. So Nice to have you, Chad. You know, I've loved you since you were a child. So
can I close with this? And Kurt, I think maybe we've been replaced. I think that you know, Sean and Chad can take this from now. Right?
I'm good with that. I love being
what is it, Coach?
Awesome.
We're good.
We sure appreciate your time, and Sean and Chad appreciate so much the questions. I wanted to just read this quote that I heard a while ago, Steve, when you were talking about Primary Children's. Sergeant Johnny Jones had both of his legs blown off in the war, and he said, "People ask how I stay so positive after losing my legs. I simply ask them how they stay so negative with theirs." Anyway, I think it's I could not stop taking notes during that entire time. And so, thank you so much, Steve, Chad, Sean.
We ought to close with Jeffrey Holland's quote from Sunday, when he talked about what we need to look for in the future, just to cure the healing and to poverty and the wellness of the next generation. I was floored when he said that. I was like, yes, let's go do that. In business, in personal lives, we got a lot of inspiration today. Great. I love that little quote about legs. That's awesome. You guys are the best. Love you.
Thank you, guys. Everyone. Hey, and we'll be back again next week with our next podcast. Thanks to all our listeners.